in the mafia.
Am I in the what?
Whatever you want to call it, organized crime.
That's total crap. Who told you that?
Dad, I've lived in the house all my life. I've seen police come with warrants. I've seen you going out at 3 in the morning.
So you never seen Doc Cusimano go out at 3 in the morning on a call?
Did the Cusimano kids ever find $50,000 in Krugerrands and a 45 automatic while they were hunting for Easter eggs?
I'm in the waste management business. Everybody immediately assumes you're mobbed up. It's a stereotype, and it's offensive. And you're the last person I would want to perpetuate it.
Fine.
There's no mafia.
That's right. There is no mafia. What are we doing here? Stereotyping Italians all of a sudden. Welcome to Cut to Black, a Sopranos sit down. I am Jim Scampoli, and there is no mafia.
I'm Jacob Burrows, and there's no mafia. There's no podcast. What are we even doing here? It's just a regular, ordinary show about a working class fella called Tony. He's got psychological issues. Sometimes he dreams of violence, but is it real? Who knows? I honestly don't know. That could be like season 5 shit. I would assume not. Show would not be as popular, I think. We're here to talk about episode 5, as you heard in the clip. It's called College.
Yes, and it's a very self-contained episode. You could almost plop this down in front of some idiot's eyeballs, and they could watch it from beginning to end, and they would have no real questions. They completely understand everything that's going on.
Yeah, I feel that way. I'm that idiot. It's true. It's a very different feel. You said last week to me that it's kind of, this is an episode that's kind of known as them finding their feet or something like that. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, this is actually Time Magazine has declared this is the best episode of The Sopranos. So you have peaked, Jacob. I don't know.
Oh, gosh. Do we further. Stop?
In Time Magazine's top 10 Sopranos episodes, this is number one. TV Guide in 2009 named it the number two episode of TV episodes in general of all time. Narrowly losing out to the contest episode of Seinfeld.
Okay. Do you agree that it's the best episode of The Sopranos?
I don't. It's definitely top tier Sopranos, and especially for season one, where it's very clear. I think David Chase said that this episode kind of has all the elements of the show in kind of a self-contained story, where it's like the point of the show here is a guy dealing with having his home life and his mafia life and how those things can clash repeatedly and just dealing with that type of stuff. So I wouldn't go so far as to say it's the best episode, but I understand what people are saying, and it's towards the top of the heap.
All right. And I'm, you know, as we all know, just a little 5 years old. And maybe I'll have a different perspective on my, I don't know, seventh run of The Sopranos, because I'm sure that whoever put it as number two has seen it like 100 times, and they've seen the greatness to a greater degree than I have. I thought this was a great episode. I thought last week's episode was really great too, though. Yeah. And honestly like my favorite was last week's. It's really good, this one. Don't get me wrong. But it's crazy to me to hear that out of all the episodes, they think this one is the best when I have seen 5, and I don't even feel it's the best of those. But it's totally, I'm coming from a totally different perspective, I think. And like, I'm just excited about the stuff going on the local level. And this is, as you said, totally separate to a degree that this is a unique Sopranos episode for me. It's like one thing. It's like one story happening in one episode. And like, I barely had to write down notes, because otherwise we go through and it's like, then this scene and then this scene, and you kind of keeping track of what's going on. And here it's impossible to jumble up the order of things because there's just one story. And well, there's a B story, but it's all like, it's all during the course of a very limited period of time, which makes it very different. I don't think any other episode has felt like that.
Yeah, it's pretty much a 24-hour period for the most part. And yeah, the two stories are driving, like the most important things are all happening over the span of one night. So I do think it's an interesting choice, like kind of in the middle of the season and as things are kind of ramping up in Jersey with like our like main plot of the season, you know, with Tony and Uncle Junior and his mother and even therapy, it's, you know, there's a small nod to it because there is a revelation to Carmilla about Tony's therapist, but we don't have any of those cool scenes where Tony can talk about how he really feels. It's all this self-contained story. And I guess now it's probably a little bit more commonplace with everything being peak TV and TV being like the replacement of movies to kind of do little things like this.
Yeah.
But for the time, I think it was a big deal. It's like, wait, what? What's going on? But it's still such a solid story that it works.
I think that makes sense because I've seen people do this a lot. I've seen people do this, and most of the time it doesn't work because they go off and do a different episode for a bit. Like, and it almost always feels like it detracts from the momentum of the story. It kind of feels like, well, we wanted to do an episode in LA or whatever. We wanted to go and do a special episode. And so, I mean, obviously it works sometimes, but I can see what you're saying because if I wasn't expecting this, I don't know. It was a totally different landscape in those days, I feel.
Well, and what I think is interesting is that it does continue kind of, I don't want to say a breakthrough, but I mean, the last episode did deal with Tony's kids, you know, figuring out who he really is.
Yeah.
So instead of it continuing the story we think it is, like, oh, now Tony's in charge and he makes Uncle Junior thinks that he's in charge, we explore that more with Meadow because in the previous episode, she was just kind of giving the lowdown to AJ, but now we see her actually confront her father to get the truth and see like if he will be truthful with her. And it's interesting because then throughout the episode, of course, even though he kind of gives her a little bit where, you know, okay, some of my money comes from illegal gambling and whatnot, but then the rest of the episode though, he is just lying about that life where, I mean, clearly he can't be like, no, I gotta bounce real quick and murder this guy. Yeah. Check out the call, just get me a paper. I'll be back.
Well, that was kind of my conclusion. Is there was a significant line at the end where he says it takes two to tango. Like when she's saying like either like don't we have this special relationship? And he says either we do or we don't. It takes two to tango. And I read that as kind of him saying like, well, if you're going to know about this, you also should know that you can't be asking questions all the time.
Yeah.
Duh, more or less, because he doesn't want to lie. But the more questions she's asking, the more he has to lie. But let's go to the beginning where we start out with a sweaty, out of place Tony in a college environment. I thought it was another dream, honestly, like the last episode or maybe two episodes ago was a dream at the start. They talk about why he never finished college because Meadow comes out and it's clear they're doing this sort of tour looking at colleges. And he talks about how he got into a little trouble as a kid. and then in the car, Meadow turns off the radio and asks the question and we hear the clip from the start of the show.
Yeah. And one thing too, I'm not spoiling anything, but I'm just saying like details from these early episodes are things that come up again and again, because even in this episode, when he says, you know, I had my semester and a half, he was proud of that when he was talking to Melfi in an earlier episode.
Yeah.
Maybe even was the pilot, I think, because he's like, you know, I had a semester and a half in college, so I understand Freud as a concept.
Yeah.
And he kind of talks about it here. And I'm just saying, like, this may not be the last time you've heard Tony talk about his semester and a half at college. And it's such a nothing thing. But I like these little moments that he brings up. But yeah, then it gets to the point where, yeah, right at the beginning, you could tell she's kind of thinking about it. She's flipping through stations, turns the radio off. And as you heard in the opening clip, are you in the mafia? And Tony goes into immediate defense mode and then kind of gives her a little bit like, okay, yes, illegal gambling. We do make a little money from there.
Yeah, I think he realizes how ridiculous he sounds when he says, there is no mafia. And she looks at him like, well, I already didn't believe you. And now, like, why are you shouting that there's no mafia? And he seems to realize, and as he said, gives her a little bit whatnot. And she's just happy that he's being honest. And they talk about, like, how that makes her feel. Because he cares what his children think about him, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah, she talks about how some other dad is working for big tobacco and some other dad is a lawyer or whatever. Like, they're just as bad, more or less. And he's like, oh, yeah, cool. So they kind of start off on a good vibe. And then it all starts going a little wrong because While he's calling his mistress at first from a payphone, which for an hilarious conversation about her friend who's an amputee from Russia, and she's already getting married and got carried out of the mall when her prosthetic leg fell off, like a prince carried her out, and she's getting married. Why are we not getting married? And he's like, okay, I'm gonna call my wife real quick.
Well, no, it's instead. Great because his line is, well, first he tries to bring up, like, because she's clearly staying in like a nice hotel suite that he's paying for. He brings up like the jacuzzi jets or something, like, how the jacuzzi jets? And she says like something in broken English about, like, you know, don't throw things in my face. And
throw
then
up things in my face, yeah, I think, maybe.
Yes, that's what it is. And then Tony, like, she starts going on and on again about marriage and a future, and Tony just makes this face and goes, I gotta go, my kid's coming. Like, yeah. Meadow's not coming, he just doesn't want to deal with this right now. And yeah, makes another call, and poor Carmilla's home sick with the flu, and he completely ignores her because he's distracted as he sees a guy pumping gas that might be a familiar face to Tony Soprano.
Yeah, and they race off because, I mean, he just a second ago, he was like revealing a bit of himself to Meadow, but now he's revealing a whole lot more, if unintentionally, because he's like, come on, let's go. And he's got like his Mario Kart face from the first episode. Where he's all happy to be chasing someone down and driving crazy. And she's like, what are you doing? And everyone's shouting that he's a crazy asshole in traffic trying to pass when he can't pass. And but he's just laughing like, hey, just have a little fun. And she's like, what's going on? But he does drop it when he figures out, I guess, where the car is going, or when he has to make a turn. I wasn't quite clear on like why, but they arrive at the motel.
Yeah, it's a little weird because at first Meadow's acting like they're supposed to be going to the Colby College, because it's like Colby left, but he takes a right. But then when he takes a right, she's like, oh, this goes to Colby anyways. But then she's like, there's our hotel. So it's like, I don't know, whatever. But finally she's like, dad, our hotel. So he pulls away, kind of annoyed. But he's got the plate number. So he does make a call to Christopher, and Christopher is very annoyed because he has to go out in the rain to call from a payphone.
Yeah, what do you got? Wet shoes. So he explains to Christopher and the audience who he saw, which is rather convenient that Christopher is like coming up. He's a new kid on the block, so he gets to explain the backstory of this guy who stabbed them all in the back when he flipped and gave evidence and went into witness protection, but then went out of witness protection, I guess, and now he talks at colleges about what a big mafioso he was, which makes me feel they could have found him if they wanted to. But
yeah, that's a weird detail they throw in, that he's kind of a public persona, but also not. But apparently he's just living up in protection in Maine.
I guess he does have a different name. So, I mean, there is no Google. So I guess it's harder to find people. He also drops that his old man was sick. He never recovered when he heard the news, making it even more personal. And like talks about the other people on the crew, how they all got screwed over. And he talks about how great he is at making whatever they're called, little heads.
Yeah, like a wood. Yeah, he's making, yeah, like he's like a wood carver that makes busts of people's heads. And what, one of them was supposed to be, was it
Sinatra?
Reagan or Sinatra? And he's like, I thought it was Shaquille. And I mean, this ends up being important. It's funny because it's such a like racist joke. Yeah. But then it becomes an important element later on, because he messed up Sinatra's lips. So they thought it was Shaquille because he couldn't quite nail it. And that might come up later as an important plot point.
Yeah,
we do cut back to poor Carmilla at home, stuck with AJ Soprano, who
nightmares
to make her breakfast in bed, and he just brings one egg rolling on a plate. And I never noticed it before, but like, there's just the OJ is like spilled all over the tray that he brings to her, and then he's like annoyed that she's kind of not excited about it. He's like, what, you said poached eggs? And she says, what, I think my eyes are bigger than my stomach. And he's like, oh, you're not gonna eat it now? He's all annoyed, but
after all that work. Yeah. And then he goes off to his buddy's place conveniently, because the priest then arrives at the Sopranos' home, and she spruces herself up real quick. And that's about it for that storyline for a little bit.
It's a different actor now than the pilot.
I would have no idea. They're They're good at that. I've never. It's not like Game of Thrones where it's like, oh, welcome. And everyone turns to the camera, the mountain. And I'm like, okay, I guess that's the mountain now. Yeah, I never would have been able to tell.
Yeah, because he's in it so quick in the pilot anyways. And it's just another guy. It's not a big deal. But yeah, so because, I mean, clearly Carmella, I mean, we've seen what she deals with Tony anyways. Plus, she knows Tony. Has had women on the side, even though now he's saying he's a changed man, and whatever she's not getting from Tony, she's clearly getting from this priest, whether it just be attention, some company, someone who just kind of cares to hear her thoughts on things. And even though it's kind of bad timing, because it's not necessarily that Tony was trying to be a dick to Carmella, he just kind of got caught up in his mafioso life. But perfect timing here. The Father Phil shows up. And if one thing Father Phil loves, he loves Tony's DVD player. He loves their leftovers, all their, you know, nice Italian food, baked ziti. It's even better once it's been in the fridge, because then the mozzarella gets like hardened up and then you get to reheat it. Oh, all kinds of great stuff.
Yeah, I'm very lost on all that food stuff. I mean, I get it, but it's like, okay, yeah, I don't even know what a ziti is. But okay. I mean, if we take the next part of that storyline, since we're on it, Dr. Malfi then calls to cancel an appointment, and it's awkward. And she obviously finds out that he lied. And as she says to Phil, I guess, is his name Phil?
Father Phil.
Father Phil. He says, why would he lie? Like, obviously, that means he's fucking her. And yeah, that's the thing. Why did he lie? Well, because he didn't want her to think it was weird, because he's not fucking her. But I don't know. It's one of those things that he's actually not doing anything wrong, but by lying just reflexively, obviously it becomes a much bigger thing.
Yes, for sure. Because you almost understand his thought process. Number one, it's probably weird just knowing about Tony being a masculine, tough mobster. Maybe it's a little strange to tell someone that his therapist is female. And then you add in just the regular relationship stuff in his own marriage, as far as what he's done in the past. And to him, he thinks he's just, you know, not having to deal with that discussion or argument. But of course, all that does is make things much worse. Now we're at that point.
And he's opening up to someone, and maybe he feels like if it's a man, that makes it more like a professional thing. And maybe he even feels like, well, a man, a doctor should be a man or something like that deep down, where it's like there's a level of intimacy to it that like that's inherent, because he's opening up about his life and his wife and his family and everything. And sharing that with another woman to him feels like he's doing what she's doing with the priest, but with the therapist in a way. Like, it's not sexual, except he does look at her legs in his dream. But it's kind of this counterpart where he doesn't necessarily want her to know everything about it, in the same way that Carmilla, at the end of this episode, if she hadn't found out about Melfi, maybe she wouldn't have told Tony that the car was outside all night, because she would have liked to keep that as a private thing or something like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it comes back as like a, you know, it's like a twofer, because she is being truthful, because she's not going to be like Tony and let a thing be implied to be worse than it is. But she also knows it's going to bug him. Like, it's also kind of just a way to like make it hurt a little bit, because she knows he's gonna, even though nothing happened and she knows nothing happened with Tony, and we even see like his initial reaction about it until he gets hit with the Dr. Melfi called, and then it turns into like a sitcom again where it's like, oh, come on, calm.
Yeah, this one was this and the previous episode were remarkably not sitcom-y, I guess. Not that it actually was, it just had the potential to add in some laugh tracks and stuff, which we still need to do. But yeah, so there's a ton of rainy conversations with Christopher because, of course, he calls him at first, what we talked about before, but he can't talk. He has to say, call me back at this number. And then he goes to a payphone. And there's another rainy conversation where he gets a name and address from the plates. And he goes to check out the house, but he gets spotted, more or less. And he sees the guy's family as well, but he's still not completely sure.
Yeah, yeah. And Christopher keeps trying to put his keeps trying to be like, let me do it. I'll be the guy. But mostly because, again, Christopher wants to get made. Yeah. And he's like, you know, if I do this, I'll be a cunt hair from being made or whatever. But Tony, you know, Tony knows there's history, whether it be himself or Polly or Silvio. So, and plus, he wants to, I mean, it's almost admirable that they don't want to kill a guy until they're sure, instead of being like, ah, just 50% is good enough for me, whether it's him or not. So it
makes
does
me feel, makes me sleep better at night now knowing he's dead for sure.
Yeah. And it kind of leads into like this cat and mouse game because Fred, who runs Pete's Travel, we kind of see his side of it where he's, you know, he's not just some idiot himself. He got maybe a side glance at Tony. So he thinks maybe things might be going on. And between both of them, what Tony says, it's been like 12 years or something like that. So yeah, it's understandable where it could be like, is that guy I know? I'm not sure. So it kind of leads to that. We get to see both sides of the stalking of each other.
Yeah, and that's where it gets really tense because, I mean, this Fred guy is hunting Tony while Tony is hunting him, and we get it to see him, like, go into the bar, Fred, that is, at the same time we see Meadow in the background drinking beers when she's only supposed to be having Cokes or whatever, and it all feels pretty freaky, like, we don't know, I don't know what's going to happen, and then Tony sees the bust with the big lips and knows it's the rat after all.
Yeah, it's kind of like there's the confirmation. Hey there, rat, or whatever the hell he says.
Yeah, and we skipped over it earlier, but Tony and Meadow do have dinner, and he says she looks like a model from Italian Vogue. She's like, yeah, Italian, Italian, Italian. And she opens up to him as well and tells him about doing kind of a lot of speed for a while, and he's obviously mad, but in the end he is glad that she told him. Which is interesting because he's kind of getting the reward of honesty, but seeing that honesty is not always like pretty either, just like she gets to see from him.
And Tony is trying to grill her for who did it. And as we know that it was Christopher, and even though Tony gives her that, like, you know, hey, I'm glad you were honest with me. And, you know, I know you're smarter than that. It's still very good that she doesn't tell him who did it, because either way, even if he's fine with her about it, you can imagine it probably wouldn't have been okay, Christopher.
Yeah, yeah. So she also meets these girls in the restroom, I think, and introduces them to Tony. They're from the college. And I don't know why she introduced them to Tony, because he's like, oh, they're from the college, you should hang out. And she's like, Dad, you're being so embarrassing right now. And I'm like, I thought that was the point. Or like, why were you bringing them over then?
Yeah, no, right? I agree. It almost seems like because he's the one that's been waiting for her. Because he makes that, like, I thought you fell in comment. And yeah, it almost is already set up where she's going to be like, hey, they're from the college, I'm going to hang out with them. But Tony starts saying that, and then she's embarrassed. It's kind of confusing, like turn of events. I guess it's just to get the point across that Tony's looking for an out, but still, he had an out. What is he doing?
Yeah, I guess it's just a teen thing, because I mean, basically, that's what she was gonna say. Like, she wasn't gonna say, "Let's sit down and all four of us and talk about Colby." That wasn't the idea, because she's been looking at, like, college kids the whole episode. When they're at the gas station, she's kind of glancing over she's actually talking to these guys over by another car, and when they're in the bar, she's looking at them instead of at Tony and stuff. So she's itching to try out college life in a more sort of alcoholic way already. So, and he just says, oh, you know, make sure she has Cokes, and they're like, yes, of course.
Of course.
Yeah. So at home, they're now watching a movie with Emma Thompson, the Reverend,
Yes, I was
on the
going to
film.
ask you, Remains of the Day. I've never seen this movie.
Yeah, no, me neither. I just assumed you've seen every movie in this and will school me on it.
I should have. I mean, looking over it real quick, Lord Darlington has died a broken man, his reputation destroyed after he was exposed as a Nazi sympathizer.
Oh, well, I know it's based on a book by the guy who won the Nobel Prize like this past year. Yeah, in 2017, he won the Nobel Prize. He's a Japanese novelist who wrote that book. I read like the summary of his books because no one reads Nobel Prize winning books. I read the summaries. So yeah, I guess it's based off that. Have
Yeah,
no idea what it's about, but great actors.
Anthony Hopkins plays James Stevens, who's the butler of Darlington Hall. But then we find out that the man he served, Lord Darlington, was a Nazi sympathizer. But I guess he knew that, and he still served him. And I don't know. It becomes a sad thing about dealing with your past. And I guess it ties in if he's, serving a man who's evil, and that's, Carmilla is kind of doing that because she does reach that point during the movie where she has to turn it off. And Father Phil is kind of like annoyed that they have to turn the movie off. I feel
Yeah.
I might just be reading too much into it, but. And then they get into confession where he has his little sacrament box. Well, actually, no, we don't get a sacrament box yet. They do confession at first where he takes out his like scarf or whatever it is, and they go back to back, and she talks about her family and Tony and her and how it affects her life and her children and her own greed. And I don't know, what's your read on Father Phil?
Well, I mean, he talks about, or she talks about like allowing evil in her home or whatever. And he always seemed kind of cool with Tony, except he's coveting his wife like so hard. So he's all like, that's a sin already. As far as I know the Bible, like that's already bad. He's already doing the sins. So I think that's maybe overcompensating. I mean, then we do go immediately into communion in that storyline where he brings out the box and everything, and the way it's shot is so central. It's crazy, like showing like slipping her the wafer and the wine. It's all extreme close-ups, so sexual. And then he gulps down the rest of the wine because they've already been drinking wine. But I was like, I'm not a Catholic. I don't know. Maybe that's how it works. Maybe like if there's anything left over, the priest has to finish it. It sounds like a great party game or something. Like who's the priest? And then you get wasted. But yeah, he drinks it, I guess, for liquid courage or for something. They're clearly very close to kissing after that.
Well, and even that, like, when she's like kneeling in front of him, and he puts like his hand on her head, and yeah, it's all like very on the nose, but it works like it's supposed to be, obviously.
Yeah, and I mean, Tony says that later. Like, she's like, says that she got communion, and he's like, yeah, I bet he slipped you a wafer or whatever, implying it as a sexual thing, as the show itself obviously makes it out to be. But yeah, I don't know. What's your read on him?
Yeah, it's such an it's a interesting character, and I guess it's like just supposed to show, kind of like the hypocrisy of religion, because there's like yeah, he loves hanging out at the house. He loves being able to eat their food and drink their wine and watch their TV and everything like that. So there's a sense of like he doesn't tell her for her absolution to, leave and get far away from this and build your own life. He's just like, no, you gotta, you can make Tony a better man and all that, which it's not, I mean, it's not good advice. It's not terrible advice, but it's not good advice either. It's clearly not something I don't think a outside party would say, if it was like a legit priest or even a therapist.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like he doesn't want to mess it up for him, is like the feeling I get, like, because that would mess up his good deal that he's got going on. And yeah, he clearly enjoys this, I guess, their own cat and mouse game of like, will they, won't they?
Yeah.
But he gets to keep it at a nice reach. Because, I mean, I guess he gets sick because he's drunk or whatever when they're about to really get to the moment. But I read it as there's probably a little bit more self-awareness there. And he knows he can't go at least cross that line.
Yeah, and maybe if we're being more generous, one could say that he actually wants to tell her, leave Tony or whatever, come make out with me instead. But he knows that would be selfish and bad of him. He thinks that would be like the wrong thing to say, even though she might actually want to hear that. I mean, I don't think that would end well either, but maybe that's what she wants to hear. And he feels this energy between them as something that is evil in a way, like it's bad. And he can't tell her to do that, obviously. Because that would be being a bad priest. So he's trying to repair things. But yes, also he wants to keep eating their food. Yeah. So it's a little bit of both, I think. So we get a very tense scene at the motel where Fred has a shot at killing Tony. But Meadow's there. I don't think that's what stops him. It's like another couple coming out of the motel. Like a big couple. And I mean, I guess the whole situation would have gone to hell if he had done anything, as Tony kind of says later that, yeah, kill me. Great idea. You think you would survive that ever? But yeah, he would have done it, I think, if he had a better shot.
Yeah, I think he would have done it. It's kind of flimsy that he doesn't just because someone opens the door, like a couple comes out. But I guess thinking about it, it is his turf. Like he lives around that area. He's known. It's like, somewhat seems like a pretty small town, even though there's like colleges in the area. He seems like a known dude where if he was spotted or then had to kill, like just killed his guy, his daughter, and then an old couple, like and now he's got like a serial killer on his hands.
Yeah. I don't even care about police just as far as what the Sopranos would do or his crew would do in response the end.
So. Yeah. Especially because, I mean, not that he knows this yet, but yeah, Tony's already at least made contact with Christopher, where they have he has some information on what's going on. But yeah, so he ends up not doing it there. One thing that threw me a little bit is then we see Tony does make another call at the payphone because Meadow kind of stumbles out still like drunk. And she's still asking, like, why are you always on the payphone? Because, you know, we've had this moment at the beginning where it feels like they're on this same page and it's like a truthful father-daughter relationship, but he has to continue to lie to her.
Yeah.
But Fred is not there. But then in the next scene in the morning when they leave, it's like Fred's there watching them, and they try to make it seem like he's been there a while.
He's on the phone because he's telling Christopher to stay put. He's saying that this is his business, he's gonna deal with it.
Yeah.
And Meadow comes out, and it's a tense scene because I thought there was a possibility at any moment of a gun going off. But I don't think they show him during that scene. It's as you said, it's as if he's not there. And I guess maybe they did that just to add tension because we already had a scene where he had a gun pointed at them. And now when we have a scene where we don't see him, it makes it even more unsure of what's going on. On the other hand, that phone call seems, I don't know, there's so many phone calls in this episode from payphones that I see where you're coming from. It's a little bit confusing why he wouldn't have done something then if he was there. So we'll assume he wasn't there or he fell asleep in his car or something. But we kind of have to do some guesswork.
Yes. Yeah. It's cheating a little bit. It doesn't ruin anything really, but I think it's just a little bit of cheating. And so, yeah, then, we kind of went over what Father Phil and Carmilla have been up to. And it's interesting because it's like Tony's dealing with a drunk, sick Meadow. Carmilla's dealing with a drunk, sick priest.
Yeah.
And, we come in the next day and Tony's messing with Meadow because she's all hungover. And we see that Fred's like watching him. He's got the binoculars and he's kind of staking them out or what have you. And, he's kind of, let me say Tony being stalked. Yeah, he's just being stalked by him. And then Father Phil wakes up and he, like, the realization comes to him because he's like, oh no, my car's been out front all night. What are people going to say? Because there's that reality that this is Tony Soprano's house and people do talk. So if word gets around to Tony, you don't know what kind of actual, you know, cement shoes you might have in store for you.
Yeah, I think he was like, I like the scene where he's waking up and she's in the foreground doing her thing, because the mood is so totally the opposite of the night before. And yep. She's pretty cold to him, and he's trying to like talk about, hey, what happened and whatever. And she's kind of like, yeah, nothing happened, whatever. And it's almost like him not holding his liquor is seen as a rejection of her or something along those lines, because that's the way they talk about it, where he's like, yeah, it's not that you're not attractive or whatever, or it's not that I don't have lust for you in my heart or whatever he says. But yeah, she does her little joke, which gets them in a more positive mood again about, hey, why'd I have to get the only straight priest? Which was good.
Give up the new priests in the world. Why might have to be straight?
Canuck? Is that what she says? What's she saying?
I think Fanuk.
Fanuk? I don't know what that is. So,
I guess it's just some sort of... oh, here we go.
Domination.
Brazilian Americans actually say something like Fanoik. But perhaps Fanuk, fennel. It's a relationship between homosexuality and fennel. Something to do with fennel.
All right. Cool.
I guess it started as Fanokio, and then it became like Fanoik, and then it became Fanuk. It's a derogatory term for homosexual or gay people. It's weird that it came from Fanokio.
Yes, it is. Something to do with the nose. I don't know. But yeah, where do they leave things? Because it's kind of like he gives a little touch of the cheek and then he kind of lumbers out of there. And he's so clearly lost his prestige, because he has this collar all the time and he has this like, I'm this priest person. And when he wakes up, he's kind of unshaven and unfocused and hungover, and he just has a t-shirt and he doesn't look like a priest. He doesn't look like this person of authority or person who should or could be respected anymore. He's kind of been stripped down. He says, yeah, it's not that I don't have desire for you in my heart, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I don't know. I would guess that things would cool down significantly between them moving forward, not having seen the rest. Like, I can't imagine the next time it's like, okay, this time we get to that point again, but we go all the way. This is like them coming up to the edge of the cliff and almost going over it and then not for their various reasons.
Well, and yeah, going back to the start of the scene, like you mentioned, I do like that it kind of stays as just like a one shot for a bit. Like, yeah, it's focused on her and you see him kind of get up. And yeah, he's stripped down. He's just in a t-shirt. He's just a regular like piece of garbage now. Yep. And it stays on her and she doesn't even like turn and look at him for a while. And it's, yeah, completely all the chemistry is kind of drained away. And it's an interesting parallel, because in the earlier scene, like when he first shows up and he mentions, what's her name from that movie?
Emma Thompson.
And he has his like poetic, like, well, what is it to look at a beautiful woman than like a sunset or, you know, other God's creations? And he's like looking Carmilla in the eyes, and it's kind of you could tell that he kind of likes more that, not really subtle, but like that passive, like playfulness.
Yeah.
But now he's trying to be direct about it, and it doesn't seem as I don't want to say genuine, but it just doesn't have that same hit that it did before when he was talking.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, I guess it is because the way Carmilla is acting to him, and you know, I do get the sense that he's just getting more worried, because not only the car's been out there all the time, now AJ, like you hear AJ come in and he's like, I'm home and all that. And it does seem like this scene setting up that this is going to be like a running secret. Like, when's Tony going to hear about this? And I do like that by the end of the episode, they take all the air out of that, where Carmilla just kind of tells him straight up like what happened.
Yeah. And I don't know, like we just leave them like that. And it's feels like it sputters. And I don't know. I would guess we're not going to see so much of this character anymore. But I guess we'll see. I was thinking about Fred and what his plan was, and I really think he like went home because Tony was in there. He knew he wasn't get to him. I think he went home, I don't know, to calm his wife or whatever, so he wasn't gone all night, and
That's
then
right.
came back very early to like be ready when they would come out and find out where they were going, because the next time we see him, he's trying to do a deal with some addicts that
Yeah.
he's obviously selling drugs to. And I love the little details interspersed here. I love that like the person just says no, because usually this scene is setting up something, you know, and then it doesn't set up anything, because they just say fuck that. No, that's fucked up, because even though they're addicts, they're not murderers. And he thinks like, yeah, you're not gonna get another bag off me. And he tries threatening them, like, want the cops to know who burnt down the historical house? We were volunteer firemen together. And they're just, fuck you, fuckwad. And
Well,
it's
it's nice
like,
too, because
yeah.
it shows us that this guy thinks that he still has the swagger that he had when he was mobbed up, like
Yeah.
you get the sense here that he would have this conversation in the past and people would be too afraid to say no. And even though he's clearly got his own thing going on the side, like even though he's this witness protection guy, like yeah, we learned so much that he does run something on the side selling drugs and I guess knowing that someone burned down historical society. This show's so good at dropping things like that. Like we've mentioned it in the past episodes where just a line can tell us so much about a relationship from someone.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's so great because they're and these people are made out to be so schlubby and like loserish that you do lose a lot of respect for them that they're kind of like fuck you no fuck off they
Yeah.
don't care about them.
And he hears a noise, so he sneaks out of his little building, and I'm just amazed and mesmerized by this business he owns, I guess, that's in a trailer that's standing on cinder blocks, and it just says travel with red letters, and there's like a duck with a with spinning wings for the wind. And it's so weird because I've never seen a building like that, and I can't imagine anyone would go in there to buy a trap. Maybe it's because make this place as awful as possible so people will want to go somewhere else. But even just getting to that place, because it seems in the middle of nowhere, it's such a weird little business. And I guess maybe it's all a front for him dealing his bags of cocaine or whatever he sells to these addicts. But I don't know. It's such a weird little place. Is New England full of these places, Jim?
Not that I'm aware of. And I'd been to Maine a bunch of times. Although I guess Maine is a lot of places out in the middle of nowhere, like just, cottages and staying on the lake. So, but yeah, I was
Yeah.
even thinking that too. I was like, look at this trailer that he works out of. it's so shitty.
Yeah, with these weird windows that are like steel, like square windows. It's not an inviting place. And he has just huge signs and stuff as he's moving around with his gun slowly, trying to get a read on what's going on. And he hears a noise, but it's okay. It's just a deer. Surprise, it's Tony Soprano. He's here to strangle you. And he kills him.
Well, it's great because it's almost like this guy could have had his own Sopranos type show, and it was all about, being in protection and dealing with his past, and maybe the deer was his version of the ducks, and we just see his season finale here, or series finale, I should say. But yeah, I like the moment because it's played up almost like a horror film, because yeah, he is being stalked. He's got the sounds over here, sounds over there, and then a nice deer to play in that was all part of Tony's plan, I imagine. And yeah, Tony comes up behind him with some like cables. They look like I don't know, not spark plugs, but like battery cables or something from a car. I don't know. And he just decides to choke him out, do it the old-fashioned way.
Well, you just made me realize something, which is I may not have watched The Sopranos, but have you watched the show called Lilyhammer?
I have not, but
It
I've heard good things. Silvio's on it, isn't he?
Silvio's the main character, and he's basically the same character. But he's gone into witness protection in this story. So he is someone who has flipped or whatever, and he's got to go and live somewhere, and he's seen the Norwegian town of Lillehammer in the Winter Olympics of 94 or wherever, whenever it was. So he's like, yeah, that seems nice. I want to go there. But it's this middle of nowhere podunk town, and he just starts using his mob tactics to kind of buy a bar and kind of build up a crew. And then he has rivalries, but it's all with like, we're the biker gang, and or like even worse, like we're the hunters, or like even just these small groups. And as you said, the deer, there's a lot about wolves in that, because obviously there's like, we have to kill the wolf, but it's illegal to kill a wolf, but it's killing my friend's cattle. Like, it's, that's the level of like, they take all this stuff and put it in a totally different context where everything is so out of place, and they have like these idiot redneck, like Norwegian redneck characters, that it's so in contrast with who he is. So it's a really fun show that we probably need to watch after or in between doing The Sopranos.
I like that idea. I got to check it out.
Yeah. So he kills him. He says, I could have killed you outside the motel. Your daughter was drunk. I was in the parking lot and everything. And Tony kind of looks around. He doesn't seem like spooked by that, but it almost makes him feel like, is there someone else here or what? And he says, I didn't do it because of her. I told myself it was just a coincidence. But I mean, Tony's not swayed. And I thought if anything, he would have been swayed by seeing like his family, like, oh, he has a family or whatever. But then I like forget. No, he's Tony Soprano. He doesn't care. He doesn't even seem affected at all as he kills him. He's angry and he's glad to get his revenge. And he's a murderer. And we forget this because we hang out with him so much. And he's usually not murdering people.
Yeah. And reading about this episode, I guess David Chase, it was a big fight with HBO on the executives or the suits. The suits are trying to tell David Chase, the audience isn't going to like Tony Soprano. You can't have your main character brutally murder someone in the fifth episode. And I think that's also plays into the choice to have him murder him this way, because it isn't as simple as just a like walk up behind someone two in the head or whatever. It's like a violent, you know, he's foaming at the mouth, choking the life out of this man. But David Chase said, no, if he doesn't kill this guy, the audience will not respect Tony Soprano. And that's how he'll lose the audience. Mm. And as we could see, David Chase did win out in the argument. And we don't hate Tony yet. Even after watching him doing this, and even though the show goes out of its way to show this man has a family and a small daughter or a young daughter, we're still with Tony. We understand why Tony had to do this, because they took an oath. That man took an oath.
Look, I'm still with Tony. I'm still with Christopher. He killed someone in the first episode for basically no reason. It was a dumb thing to do, and it didn't progress anything. I didn't care. Obviously, this is a lot more brutal and up close and personal. But yeah, I guess just conventions and things made me expect that at least there would be some flicker of doubt, but there really doesn't feel like there is at all. He's kind of enjoying killing this guy, but he does have the moment afterwards. I think if he just walked off and went off to Meadow like, yeah, it would be pretty different, because he has a moment afterwards of stillness when he sees the ducks fly away. And it's so great because they've already done the groundwork for this scene. So when that happens, we get to try to interpret what he's feeling. We don't have the therapy sessions because we've already had those in preparation, talking about what it means to him. He sees that now. And now we're not given like the helping hand of a voiceover in therapy saying what he fucking felt or whatever, where we have to understand or try to understand ourselves, which is good television.
Absolutely. Because it's like when I believe my first thought when I watch this is I always think that he's going to pass out. But then again, I guess it's more like he's at peace, I guess. It's like I don't know. Like, what do you take from the moment when he's like looking up at the ducks fly?
Well, I think it connects to another moment that's kind of easy to forget, but I think it's important when he's at the next college and he sees a quote by Hawthorne from the Scarlet Letter that's saying like that no man can wear one face to what I don't have it up. I don't have it pulled up, but it says that no man can wear one face to the public and one face to himself and without being confused as to which is which. And like connecting that to what he's happening there, the whole episode is about that and about truth or lying to his family, keeping things from them. And the ducks, as we know, represent his family. And when they flew away, he was terrified of losing them. But yeah, I guess that's part of it. It's hard because I didn't expect him to fall over at all in that moment. I sort of expected. I don't know. It's just a good moment. It's so ambiguous that I don't know. I think he doesn't know what he's feeling in that moment, you
Yeah,
know?
it's and like you said, it's a nice give and take because the way the show has had those therapy scenes to kind of flesh out and explain some things a little bit more to you, it is such a brilliant move to then have this and kind of let you take your own thing from it. And yeah, the quote, no man for any considerable period can wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which may be the true. And yeah, I mean, two great moments. I mean, as it's finishing out the episode, between that shot with him looking up at the ducks, and then yeah, him, staring at the quote, and then like the fucking wise ass kid that just walks by and is like, it's one of our the most famous alumnus. What an
Yeah,
annoying.
that was fucking weird because I didn't understand if he was even saying that, you know? It was cut kind of weird.
Weird.
But yeah, there's also a scene in between where he picks up Meadow, who's again had to wait for her for his fucking had to wait for him longer than she expected. And of course he lies because obviously he does. And we get this scene we talked about in the beginning where she's so onto him. And it feels like the trust from before of their special relationship is blown away. And as I said at the start, he says it takes two to tango, which I kind of read as like, this is a little dance we're doing. If you don't want to dance your steps, like, you should have never asked me about this, something like that.
I really like your read of that because I always thought it felt weird the way he says that, but I think your read on that is like nails it. Like it makes way more sense to me now because it does seem like he just blurts that out. And I think you're absolutely right. That's kind of what he's saying. It's like I can be truthful to you to a point, but I mean for your own protection and like the protection of our relationship. Obviously you can't keep asking it and expect the full truth because, she's not gonna ever look at him the same way.
Yeah, and that's when she says, like, Dad, and he's like, What? And she's like, Nothing. But then there's a silence, and he says, I love you.
Well, yeah,
And
because
I love, yeah.
and the lead up, just to backtrack a little bit, because yeah, he's just making up crazy stories because there's so many things that are jumping out between chasing a man down like the previous day. Now he's got mud all over his boots. Supposedly he was trying to find his watch and then his hands cut. And just finally you have to just accept it and be like, okay, that's what happened. There's no use like thinking about it anymore because I don't want to know the truth.
Yes, and that brings us to the end where he comes home and Carmilla tells him about the priest staying over and he thinks it's a joke at first. And yeah, as you said, then he finds out that she knows about Melfi and he's like chasing her up the stairs like, come on, what are you doing? I thought it was a thing. And then the episode's over.
Because it just feels like such a honeymooners type, classic sitcom thing. And it really tells us, I mean, we already know why Carmilla is being the way she is because there's no hint of like worry with how she's talking to Tony. I mean, partially because she knows nothing bad happened, so there's nothing to really worry about, but mostly because she has this like double win in her back pocket or what have you. Like basically she has this checkmate ready to go. And it's funny because like she tells like, oh yeah, Father Phil Intintola, I think his name is, stayed over and he's like all night. And he's like, at first he's like, oh yeah, right. And she's like, okay. Like she's not even gonna continue it then if he's not gonna take it seriously. And as we had mentioned, and he has his comments about it, like slipping the communion, which she says is starting to be like bear on sacrilege with the way he's talking. And yeah, Dr. Melfi called. Oh, we forgot to say that when Melfi does call And she's like, oh, can I, you take down the number? And Carmela says, I lost my pen. Or I lost my pencil up his ass.
Which makes us realize why they fell in love in the first place. Because what great rapier wit. And how could you not want that by your side until death do you part?
And then we lead to our like Ralph Crampton scene where he's like, Carm, I didn't know how to tell you. I thought it would be weird. Carm. Yeah. And yeah, back to, you know, suburban life, huh? Like I'm the guy, I'm always bumbling things up and trying to ask my wife for forgiveness.
It's a good episode. And I think, as we talked about in the beginning, from my limited perspective, it's probably because it's so different that it kind of made people, like it caught people off guard when they were watching it for the first time, especially if they were watching it a long time ago when every show hadn't already taken inspiration from The Sopranos. And if you see this, it's so different and such a unique thing that I can totally see how this episode would get you on board if you weren't on board already. And the thing is, if I sat down and watched this on my own, not doing a show, I would have seen this episode immediately. I would not have seen it after 4 weeks or whatever of talking about it. We've talked about this show as much time as I've watched it because we've done one episode per episode and we generally talk for an hour. So I think I've like not overanalyzed it, but I've let all the cool parts of the other episodes sink in because I feel that they could definitely kind of speed past you, especially if you watch like four in a row. We're no strangers to watching four episodes of a show in a row, and yep, things might get repetitive or whatever, and then this comes out of nowhere, kind of, this episode, and it's a change of pace that I think works very well. That's my take on it. I liked it. Wasn't my favorite, but there you go.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's something that kind of could catch the audience off guard where you start to think like you understand where everything's going. And then they kind of throw you off road for a little bit to kind of hammer a few things home and then get back on track. So and it's an interesting choice to do so early in the show's run. I think it just threw people for a loop in a good way. Not in like, a lot of shows do things like this where you get to a cliffhanger and then they sidetrack you for no reason. And then you feel more cheated, where this, it just works a lot better. So there you go.
That's the episode. And if you have thoughts and opinions, if you're watching along with us, please do send in your thoughts and feedback to showswhatyouknowshow@gmail.com or leave a comment on our YouTube. That's youtube.com/showswhatyouknow. We also have a Twitter where we generally tweet out when we're going to go live, which is every Sunday during our Cut to Black Soprano sit down. And the Twitter is @showswhatyouknow, as you with the letter U. And that's where you can find the links to our live streams, which you're very welcome to join if you're watching along with us. And it's not too late to catch up. I think that covers it. Is there anything else?
One more thing.
What's that?
Cut to Black.